Drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple?
It's the early 1800s. The world is reeling from the leaps and bounds of the Industrial Revolution, and Napoleon has just crowned himself emperor. Europe is in a state of flux with wars raging across the continent. Ludwig van Beethoven is in the middle of composing some of his most popular works, and those works provide the score to wartime. Now, the ACO wants us to step into that time and join them in a concert hall in the time of Beethoven with their latest production called Beethoven's Emperor. ACO pianist Christian Bezuidenhout is my guest today, and he joins me in the studio. Christian, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Christian, to prepare for this interview this afternoon, I was listening to an ACO playlist on Spotify, and it made me chuckle to see this, but on the piano concertos, it lists you as an artist, and it has your little headshot and your smiling face, and it also lists Ludwig van Beethoven, and it has a little artist's impression of him. Does that give you a thrill to be reaching through time and collaborating with a master?
It does, Rachel, and you know, at the end of the day, we do a job. We're musicians, we're paid professionals, but you get into the rehearsal room and then you realize that one of the colleagues from the orchestra spoke to me yesterday and said, you know, this is one of those projects where you remember why we're doing this. You know, you get to play the Emperor Concerto or Mozart D minor piano concerto or Schubert Rosamunde, and you remember this is the most astonishing music of its kind. It's very humbling to be reminded of that.
What would he make of having his music streamed?
I think he would love it. I mean, Beethoven was so in tune with the market and this cult of the celebrity. I think he would have found it very attractive.
Christian, you often perform on what's called a forte piano. Am I saying that correctly?
That's correct.
Can you describe what that looks like?
Rachel, all of these pianos from the beginning of the 19th century have one thing in common. They're basically built by timber experts, craftsmen. They're made of wood by professional cabinet makers, with the exception of the strings and the tuning pins. They all have what we call straight stringing, which is very different to what Steinway unveiled later in the 19th century. Steinway did it for many reasons, but one of the biggest is that when you cross the strings of an instrument, unlike the forte piano, you gain a lot of richness, sonic complexity, and sonic density. And what the Steinway did and why it won the evolutionary battle is that it sounds really full and loud in big concert halls. And the forte piano just doesn't do that. The piano that Beethoven knew in the teens and the 20s had a tiny little hammer covered in leather. It had a non-uniform striking point, which means that every part of the piano has a slightly different sound, and they really cherished that. And it's, of course, a much lighter instrument. It might strike people as being a lot softer than the modern piano, but the added color and timbre differences of the instrument are so beguiling. I find them just irresistible.
I imagine it must be a little more difficult than playing on a modern piano.
It requires a lot of control because the action is so light that one really has to recalibrate one's technique. You're absolutely right about that.
And what about temperamental? Is there a change between, say, your rehearsal and your performance?
There is. These pianos can betray you a little bit in concert. They can be a little bit finicky, a little bit temperamental. So one has to be unbelievably zen and concentrated and kind of minimalist in one's approach to the body in order to draw the best sound from the instruments. But I like the challenge. It's a really fun kind of psychological challenge.
Does it ever work in reverse where the better sound comes on the night?
It does sometimes, especially when one's really relaxed. You can be quite surprised. It can be quite surprising, yeah.
That must be a good feeling. You have focused on these older instruments throughout your career. Do you sometimes feel like you can live the music of the time a little more authentically through those instruments?
Gosh, that's a very good question. Do you know, I've never thought of it along those lines. I think I just felt that the language of the sound of these instruments spoke to me much more deeply than anything I'd heard before. And it's fair enough to say that that was particularly true about Mozart. And that was the kind of gateway for me. I just thought that these instruments, the forte piano and the gut strings and the period winds from the time, speak a slightly more visceral emotional language that's a bit more fragile, a bit more human, not quite as perfect. And I don't mean that people don't play the instruments as perfectly, but there's a kind of beauty in imperfection, a little bit like, you know, wabi-sabi culture. You know, you love the rough corners and the rough edges. And I sort of feel that Mozart and Beethoven were deeply attracted by these sounds. They were master writers for their instruments. So that's what drew me to it.
Do you think you learn more about those performers through those instruments?
I do, absolutely. Because it reminds you that these people had absolutely the most astonishingly ahead of their time sense of orchestral and sonic sonorities. For someone like Mozart not to have been attracted by the piano he was writing for, and certainly Beethoven as well before he became more and more deaf, is just madness. I mean, these were the most gifted orchestrators of their generation.
If you've just joined us on RN Drive, I'm talking to Australian pianist Christian Bezuidenhout. We're talking about Beethoven's influences and those he influenced. Christian, tell me about your initial introduction to some of those historical instruments.
It's fair to say, Rachel, that it came through recordings. As a teenager, my father would get me a new disc of my choice every month, and things that came across into my life at that time is particularly memorable were recordings of John Elliott Gardner's Mozart Piano Concertos, Mozart Requiem, C minor Mass, Idomeneo as well. And I think I remember thinking to myself, this is a type of Mozart playing I've never heard, not in real life nor in my imagination. I want to be a part of this field. So it was more chicken and egg situation. And then I said to myself, look, I'm going to have to play the forte piano to be part of this community. And it went from there. It sort of, I wasn't desperately fascinated by the forte piano, I'd say. I just wanted to work with English Baroque soloists and the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra and, you know, European period instrument orchestras. And I realized I would never do that if I weren't playing the forte piano. So it came from that direction. And then you learn to love the new métier, the new landscape. You know, all of the things that are difficult about something become the challenges that you treasure the most, in fact.
Beethoven was composing and living in the midst of the Napoleonic Wars, and we know that Beethoven was at one stage an admirer of Napoleon. So is Emperor Concerto named for Napoleon?
No, certainly not. I think Beethoven's fascination with the whole Napoleon thing happened a lot earlier, around the time of the Eroica Symphony. And you can see that his hopes and expectations for the way a ruler should rule are dashed cruelly. I think the nickname for the emperor clearly did not come from Beethoven. It stuck sometime later, as far as I know. I'm not exactly sure, but what people so rightly get about the piece is the enormous scale and scope of the thing and the incredible grandeur and nobility of the whole piece. And I think that's one element of Beethoven that's often overlooked, is this question of the search for the eternal noble, you know, in humankind, something he writes about and something he's attracted to in poetry. But also don't forget, this is the first time ever that Beethoven is not able to play his own piano concerto in public because of the deafness issue. And that's one of the things that I find particularly heartbreaking about it, is the fourth piano concerto is the last time he's in public playing a piano concerto. And then it's just not tenable. He can't do it because it's impossible. So the piece has so many layers of significance, which are astonishingly touching in their way.
This latest production from the ACO brings us on a journey to sort of educate us about what leads to that piece, the Emperor Concerto. And it begins with a piece by Schubert, who was a student of Beethoven and revered him. Do we know what Beethoven was like as a teacher and the relationship of those two?
That's a very good question. I don't know very well. My feeling about Beethoven as a teacher is the first word that comes to mind is irascible. I mean, Beethoven as a human being is a nightmare to deal with. Severs 90% of his professional contacts, falls out with almost all of his friends. The few patrons who really did adore him, well, I mean, a few of them stick around, but Beethoven has a really great way of burning bridges.
He would have been a real headache for the HR department.
A nightmare. But I mean, for all the right reasons, people are suddenly giving this guy the feeling that he is master of the universe. This, in stark contrast to Mozart, who just never gets this kind of treatment, which is a great shame. I think Beethoven was super demanding and also knew his limitations. We see this a lot. Beethoven writes in an exasperated way about a certain passage in a Mozart trio that he just cannot get his head around. You can see him struggling a lot. And I think that's why we're so drawn to his music. The inner struggle is very, we can relate to that very deeply.
He was known to be a skilled improviser. How do you think that fits in with the concert halls and the salons of the day?
Oh, this was a big, big thing, Rachel. Every single public concert that Mozart played, for example, had to have some kind of pure improvisation. And the thing that sets Mozart and Beethoven apart from the very gifted amateurs of this time is that they can do this live. And that's what people really paid the big bucks to go and see. Beethoven's improvisations were noted for their kind of slightly wild, almost grotesque quality. And you can see this in some of the written out improvisations that we have. And in our concert for the ACO, we're sort of slightly paying homage to that, because I'll play a kind of improvisation between some of the pieces to link them, which I think is a lovely way of opening the door into what these concerts might have sounded like in the 18th century, 19th century.
This ACO production that you're about to kick off, it promises to take us on a journey through the forebears and heirs and the influencers and the influenced, so that you can stand alongside the lucky few who had their hair blown back by the magic of Beethoven's Emperor for the first time it was played. I really loved that description, Christian. It sounds like quite the education you're going to take us on.
It's a fantastically well-designed program. And I'm the first to say that the person who really shaped this program from the ground up was Toby Chad at Australian Chamber Orchestra. It's a fantastic glimpse into exactly what you say, both before and after and during. We've got Ferdinand Ries, who was Beethoven's student and who was massively influenced by Beethoven. And you can see here in this C minor symphony, echoes of the Eroica symphony, very sophisticated in parts, sometimes doesn't quite get off the ground, but very charming at the same time. Schubert is one of these people who is in this very delicate position where he has to suddenly deal with the anxiety of influence. And this means how to write a symphony after Beethoven. And Schubert struggles with this a lot because he knows that the bar is set enormously high. And then, of course, we come to Mozart, and we all know that, I think it was Ries and Beethoven who saw the C minor piano concerto of Mozart and said, look, what on earth are we ever going to do that is ever going to be anything as good as this? And they're dead right. And you hear in the D minor piano concerto, this struggle to live up to Mozart's incredible reputation at the beginning of the 19th century is crushing, but a wonderful reminder of it too. I think it's a brilliantly designed program because you've got a lot of ferocity in the Ries, C minor, trumpets and drums, but then very tender, the Rosamunde arrangement that we've made with the interleaving of the piano variations. And then, of course, the Mozart D minor piano concerto and the Emperor. It's a program of maximum variety that shows every kind of level of inspiration and directionality very, very well put together.
You're going to play a piece for us now, which, as you've spoken about, isn't actually one of Beethoven's pieces, but one of his favourite composers, Mozart. What do you think Beethoven appreciated about Mozart's work?
Wow, gosh, we don't really have enough time for this. Well, there are a few things. I think one of the things that Beethoven found astonishing about Mozart was that Mozart had this ability to tap into previously uncharted emotional territory with seemingly no precedent. And I don't just mean that Mozart suddenly writes all these pieces in a minor key, like Don Giovanni or the D minor piano concerto or the C minor piano concerto. There's a kind of spiritual and emotional depth, which I think Beethoven found utterly transforming and very frustrating as well, because Mozart somehow manages to do it with the simplest means. And I think Beethoven saw in Mozart the most gifted melodic writer of his generation. hands down. And that was something that he struggled with a lot. And I think Beethoven quickly realized that he couldn't match Mozart. So he had to find different ways of expressing things. Beethoven was wildly jealous of Mozart's counterpoint, that's for sure. And I think probably he was just frustrated by how easy things were, at least on paper, for Mozart. We know that's not true, but...
You're going to play Allemande in C minor
yes.
this afternoon. Tell us a little bit about that piece and why you've chosen it.
Well, Rachel, this comes from a time in the early 80s, 1782, when Mozart has just moved to Vienna, basically a year ago. And he comes into contact with Baron von Swieten, who's obsessed with Bach and Handel. And you have to understand, this is the first time that Mozart really gets to know mature works of Handel and Bach. And Constanze, his wife, is particularly obsessed with counterpoint and loves Bach so much. And I think Mozart writes this kind of quirky little suite in honor of her. It's unfinished, but the second movement is this absolutely astonishingly modern-sounding Allemande, which simultaneously pays homage to Handel and Bach, but also sounds at times like Brahms and Schumann in a way that only Mozart can.
Christian Bezuidenhout has been my guest today. He's directing the Australian Chamber Orchestra's offering of Beethoven's Emperor, which is opening this Saturday, the 9th of March, and running until the 24th of March. Thanks very much for your time this afternoon, Christian.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.